Hello, today is May 22nd, 2013. This is this Wednesday's weekly report. I'm Jason Ross, joined here in the studio by Lyndon LaRouche and Cody Jones, who I believe has some remarks to kick us off today.
Yes, so we will discuss, or at least start to discuss, the way forward for humanity. Now, we've been discussing, obviously, that we are, for anyone who's awake or alive, should recognize we are totally in the throes of a full-on global economic collapse. And as Mr. LaRouche has put forward, and as our movement has been fighting for, obviously the first immediate step is to set up the firewall through Glass-Steagall. But that's only the first step. We've then got to quickly go towards a Hamiltonian-style credit system, through a national banking structure, to fund such things as the NWAPA project, which would allow us to start to channel the flow of activity, of resources, to create the employment, to then start to build our way out of what's not just a monetary crisis, but an actual physical collapse for humanity, typified by what we're seeing with food shortages, our inability to deal with extreme weather, the water crisis, what have you. But all of those are just immediate measures to be taken to, in effect, do what you had said before, Lynn. We've got to first put the brakes on the collapse. That it's not just simply a matter of moving towards the positive growth process, but we first got to put the brakes on the collapse function and start to turn this thing around. Now, upon doing that, and in the process of getting there, it's going to be important to go back and see and pick up where humanity had fallen off from what had been a very real potential for an explosion in human creativity and an explosion in human progress. And I'm referring here to the period, really, which comes out of the late 1800s, early 1900s, up through the mid-1900s, with the work of people like Einstein, Planck, and others. Those who are part of this quantum revolution, so to speak, whose ideas and discoveries set the stage for what could be and should be the types of technologies to be employed to really move ourselves out of this current paradigm and to enable us to do what Mr. LaRouche has been talking about, which is to fully take control of, at minimum, for now, the inner solar system. But to do that is going to require, first and foremost, as a principle, moving into the next phase, the next platform of energy flux density technology usage. And so this means things like moving towards the use of high-powered lasers. This means moving towards things like high-energy plasmas, moving immediately to implement the use of nuclear power, which we should have done 50 years ago, but then using that as a platform to really move towards the development, the usable development of fusion power, and then things like matter-antimatter reactions. But what has to be understood is that to really fully exploit those technologies and to make them usable and applicable towards the kind of transformation that we're discussing when we talk about getting dominion over the entire inner region of the solar system, is going to mean going back to the quality of mind of those people who produce those discoveries. That's not going to simply be enough to just apply the technology, but if we're going to apply it appropriately, we're going to have to understand what was the quality of mind that produced those technologies and the discoveries that gave birth to them. So to get at that, I just wanted to use some quotes from people like Max Planck and others to give people a sense of what was this quality of mind, what was the kind of culture, what was the ontological perspective that these various great discoverers had that enabled them to make these next breakthroughs, and which, as I said, we're going to have to get back to that quality of mind if we're going to be able to apply those breakthroughs appropriately. Now, in your latest paper, Lynn, A New Meaning for Space, you really make the point that we've lost sight of the idea of both life per se and creativity per se. These concepts are often, there's an attempt to reduce them down to some sort of mechanism, you know, to build up to life from matter, or to build up to creativity as an epiphenomenon of a biological process. And that's become standard in today's, scientific community and just the population at large. But this isn't the way that the real geniuses of history have thought about it. They had a completely opposite, inverted approach to the ideas of life and to creativity, to cognition. And so just use some quotes to give people a sense of that. So we'll start here. This is a quote from Louis Pasteur on life, his idea of it. So Pasteur says, "You put matter before life, and you make matter eternal. How do you know that the progress of science will not force you to affirm that life is eternal and not matter? You go from matter to life because your present knowledge tells you that you cannot understand things in a different way. Who can assure me that in 10,000 years, we will not say that it is impossible not to go from life to matter?" And then later he says along those lines, "The universe is a dissymmetric totality. I tend to think that life, in the form we observe it, must be a function of the dissymmetry of the universe." And so you here have Pasteur, who I think people recognize was a great revolutionary in the field of biology and science, who was starting to challenge this idea that somehow you can get to life from matter, that you can build up to life. But the reality is, he saw it, as we'll see others, that life itself was a universal, that life was not something that could be reduced to some mechanism or a collection of parts, but that life expressed something universal about the nature of the universe. And he brings up this idea of dissymmetry, or I think what we can think of as something which is, it has a directionality to it. It's not a steady state thermodynamic system, but the universe is inherently directional. It's, in a sense, unstable, but unstable in a creative, directional way. And that life is an expression of that quality of the universe as a whole. Now, next person I'd like to quote here is Max Planck, who goes even further with this discussion. And if I can find that here. Oh, yes. So this is from an interview with Max Planck done in 1931. And, I mean, the whole interview is short, but there's a lot of profound ideas in it. But I'll just go with one just to give people a sense of the way that Planck thought about this. So after some discussion about aesthetics, Planck had some very interesting things to say about the relationship between beauty and science, aesthetics and science. But then they get into the question of consciousness, of mind. And so the questioner asks Planck, he says, "Do you think that consciousness can be explained in terms of matter and its laws?" And so Planck says, "No. I regard consciousness as fundamental. I regard matter as derivative from consciousness. We cannot get behind consciousness. Everything that we talk about, everything that we regard as existing, postulates consciousness." Then the interviewer goes on and says, "In reply to another question concerning the notorious difficulties that beset modern physics, particularly the phenomena of light, where we apparently have to use two sets of ideas, you know, the wave-particle duality, that are in contradiction to one another, I found that Professor Planck considered that these difficulties illustrate the extent to which the world of science depends upon the mind. For he considered that these difficulties arise simply because we regard certain concepts as being objective realities. Thus, we assume that everything that exists in nature exists in space and time. The material universe we assume is something that exists in space and time. When we regard certain modern scientific entities, as for example the light quantum, from this point of view, they seem to possess contradictory properties. Thus, certain experiments show that the light quantum is very large, and other experiments show that it is very small." Mm-hmm. Planck suggests that the light quantum is something to which the notions of spatial and temporal extension do not apply. Men must learn to regard space and time not as objective realities to which everything must conform, but as concepts which, in this region of phenomenon, must now be transcended. They are not objective realities independent of consciousness, and perhaps none such exist. And so you see, this was the quality of mind you had with someone like Max Planck, who recognized, as we've been discussing for some years now pretty profusely, that space, time, these are not ideas which we can assume are realities. And to the extent that people try to impose them as a priori realities, they fall short. They fail in the domain of science. And I think it's important to recognize that, you know, there's plenty of things we've quoted before from Einstein to similar effect. And it's important to realize where people like Planck and Einstein came from. I mean, they were part of a very rich classical culture. I mean, we've heard stories of Planck playing with people like the Klingler Quartet, which was a quartet which was came directly out of this unbroken continuity from Brahms and the Schumann circles up to Joachim, and then Klingler comes directly out of the Joachim tradition. And this is the tradition that Planck was part of. He played with these circles. And, you know, we've seen Einstein and what he says about the role of music in classical culture in determining the way he thought about science. And then you look at the way that these networks intersected, for example, Curler. And Curler's idea that you had to always go towards wholeness, that the mind did not understand things in terms of a collection of parts, but that the mind, its natural tendency was towards wholes, was towards unity, which is very much, you know, again, Klingler, he comes out of the same musical tradition of people like Furtwängler at that time, which Planck and Einstein were very much attuned to, which also approached things from the standpoint of wholeness. What's the one, what's the idea which is behind these notes, so to speak? You've got a collection of notes, you've got a collection of parts, you've got a collection of things in your visual field, but it's not the parts which build up to the one. It's the one, it's the unity which organizes the parts, which is the ontological reality behind the pieces. And so you see there's this very intimate connection at this time between the rich classical cultural tradition that goes back to Mozart, Bach, and up through Brahms, Joachim, Klingler, that Planck and others were connected to, the Furtwängler tradition at that time. And then you've got this then intersected what was an emerging science of the investigation of the mind explicitly, that people like Curler were involved in, that people like one of the other co-founders of Gestalt psychology, Max Wertheimer. You know, there's this famous interview that Wertheimer did with Einstein where he was trying to get behind and understand what was the process of discovery that led to Einstein's breakthrough on relativity. So you had at that time this coming together of classical culture, of science, and of the explicit investigation of the mind itself on the part of the Gestalt psychologist that really put us at that time in a position where we could have experienced a revolutionary leap in mankind's progress forward. Through the discoveries around quantum mechanics, the application of those discoveries to these new technologies like nuclear and fusion and other things. But unfortunately, we've seen what happened. That was attacked. It was largely killed. Science was degraded. The population was brainwashed. And we find ourselves here 60, 70 years later at the brink of potential collapse, potential extinction. And really the only way forward is to take those immediate emergency steps that we've discussed before with Glass-Steagall up through NWAPA, but then also a revival of this quality of mind, this quality of thinking, which is going to be absolutely necessary to move mankind forward.
Well, I'd like to, it's also the case that an oligarchical system, the political system, actually prevents scientific thinking. I want to use a couple of examples from Kuza to make that case. I recently had the joy of reading his work De Barillo on eyeglasses, on intellectual eyeglasses with some friends. And he really makes this point that when natural law is stifled, when you have got imperial rule, when you've got where law comes from above, from mandate, from diktat, rather than from a discovery process. Your ability to think about intention as existing in the universe, that natural law really is out there, is really, really hampered. So I just want to read a few quotes on that. For one thing, this is something that Kuza reads, says about the definition of a unit of length, for example. He says, why it was established to be such as it was and not otherwise, somebody would not know, except that in the end he would say without hesitation, what has pleased the prince has the force of law. Now that might be fine for defining the length of a foot or a yard or something like this, but if that's your general outlook on how you know what's true, that's going to prevent you from discovering things. Listen to this. This is what he has to say about understanding the intention that lies behind things. He says, he's going to use the word quiddity, which means the itness, sort of an unusual word. He says, now, to simplify a perceptual form is to remove its corruptible accidents, which cannot be the quiddity, in order to arrive at the intention of the creator intellect by making inferences on the basis of more subtle images, just as we would on the basis of oral words or written characters. We know that the object's quiddity, which is contained in those signs of and forms of the perceptible object, contained as in letters or oral words, is the intellect's intention. Thus, the perceptible object is as the creator's word, in which his intention is contained. When we apprehend this intention, we know the quiddity, and we are satisfied. Behind everything that exists, there must be an intention of why it is so and not otherwise. This is a very powerful theological concept that you can view God as being all-powerful, but if you do not also view him as being all-wise, then he can just be a capricious ruler who makes rules that are the rules because God said so, like the way a parent might talk to a young child, which can be appropriate for a young child, but doesn't quite work for adults. I mean, his view on this is important in the scientific front theologically also, where he quotes an earlier writer who said that man is a second God, that we are creators in our own right. And he takes issue with Plato on this, which I found interesting, because Plato regarded our discoveries as finding things which already existed. And Kuza says that that doesn't actually go far enough, that Plato doesn't adequately consider the claim that our mind is creating new things. He says, this is on a mathematical question, Kuza says, for if Plato had considered that claim, assuredly he would have found that our mind, which constructs mathematical entities, has these mathematical entities, which are in its power, more truly present with itself than as they exist outside the mind. And then one last one on his idea of the coincidence of opposites. He's responding to a question somebody might pose of why isn't the world simpler to understand? Why can't we straightforwardly observe things around us and then discover the truth behind them? Why don't things work that way? Because they don't work that way. The discoveries that, you know, Cody, you've been talking about, that Mr. LaRouche has laid out as the necessary train of thought to understand the history of science, none of these were straightforward. They always overthrew what came before, and they always revealed the existence of something behind the senses, mm-hmm. something of the form of an intention, rather than an invisible something that seems perceptible. Rather, what lies behind the senses is something which could not be sensed. It lives in another world. Now, here's what Kuza has to say about this question. He says, he says, for perceptible objects are the senses books. In these books, the intention of the divine intellect is described in perceptible figures, and the intention is the manifestation of God the Creator. Therefore, if regarding any given thing you are puzzled as to why it is such, or why it exists in the way that it does, there is an answer, namely, because divine intelligence willed to manifest itself to the perceptual cognition in order to be known perceptibly. For instance, why is there, in the perceptible world, so much contrariety? You are to reply, because opposites, juxtaposed to each other, are more elucidating, and because there is a single knowledge of both. Mm-hmm. So this is it's a really wonderful dialogue, which really brings together much of Kuz's philosophy. It was written towards the end of his life. Mm-hmm. But I think there are several important points made in here, one of which I just want to restate is that if you've got a legal system or a political system in which natural law is ruled out, in which there's a consent or people are forced to submit to the idea that laws come because that's what the ruler wants to do, or because some powerful agency has decided that's what's in its own interests, if that's tolerated, and the idea of the primacy of natural law is allowed to go, mm-hmm. well, first you're going to have what we've seen is expressed as fascism, and it's impossible to have science under those conditions, if that's the culture. So there's a real cultural breakthrough that we need to make. Not that we would have wanted to make scientific breakthroughs under a dictatorship anyway, but it's really not it's a cultural fight as well as a scientific one. The two go together. Mm-hmm. So,
well, as a matter of convenience, and I think a necessary convenience, have divided the immediate subject matters among three. Among objects as such, which are just objects, or we treat as objects. Then we have the principle of life, which applies to things including animals. But life as such does not suffice for mankind. Mankind has a creative capability which no animal species has. So the stupidity, of course, is simply saying we have to derive everything from objects, simply the interpretation of an interaction of objects. Mm-hmm. But that's not true, because life does not conform to that. And life also evolves. The demonstration in the history of living processes is that life evolves. It's in an upward thing, but it has a barrier, a limit to it. And the limit is found in mankind in what we would call noesis, the creative process. And that's where the problem, that's as far as we in knowledge go. Now I've gone in more deeply in this recently, in this same matter. But that's the fact to fail to take that into account already killed you, because you're floundering. I mean, the idea of the object is such, all right, we've got things we can, are satisfied, belong to the behavior of objects as such, bumping against each other and things, that sort of thing. Then you have life, all kinds of living processes which evolve in an upward direction. The overall process tends in an upward direction to a higher form. Then you get, in the case of mankind, mankind creates a universe which the animals cannot, the willful process. And then it leads higher to that. What does that mean? But those, when you get to that critical area of saying these three things have to be distinguished, they are not ontologically not identical. Therefore, you cannot go from one ontology to another without defining the interaction of the ontologies. And in this case, the human ontology is essentially noesis, which does not exist in the animal world. The animals evolve. That's a process. All kinds of things, life, evolve. That's a characteristic of life. But there's something that goes beyond that kind of life, is human noesis, where mankind intervenes and introduces a new rule, which the animal kingdom is not capable of doing. But these are only the approximations, but you have to use these simple approximations in order to get on a clear foundation, which leads to the next thing, which I'm doing on this other process. There is a noetic process, an inside to the noetic process, which goes beyond the animal range. And that's where the real fun comes. But you've got to get to this triad of structure before you can get into the higher domain. And that's what I'm fussing about. That's what's essential. is to understand what the higher form is. And this you approach simply by negation. For example, you take the case of Mars. Well, you have to do a lot of negation to deal with the Mars problem. And mankind has to find in himself secret capabilities which go beyond the simple human development, noesis. There are higher forms, and the fun part of the whole space program is to get pushing at the door, like trying to get inside the door of what lies beyond simple noesis. And that's what we should be pushing. And when people think that way, and they push that way, and they find examples that fit that way, and go into ecstatic states of joy at these discoveries, that's mankind. And that's what's lacking. It's all this simplistically mechanistic interpretation of everything. Mm-hmm. They have a simple deductive approach to everything. And deduction is destruction.
Especially when you throw in practicality on top.
Oh, that's terrible. That's dirty. No, but this is it. So I think from a standpoint of a simple discussion, without going into the higher realm, the first thing we have to do is we have objects which we define as objects, which are not living. We don't attribute a characteristic of life, which doesn't, for us, does not normally exist in terms of any objects we throw around. We take certain forms of activity, we call that life. It is a unique quality. And then you have a higher form, which is mankind. Now the animals evolve, plants evolve. They evolve in that sense. So there's a change process. Mm-hmm. And the change process is from non-life to life. But that's not satisfactory. You have to get to the next phase. You have to go from life to human life, to the human mind, which is a noetic process, which does not exist simply among the animals. The animals can learn, like the puppies can learn.
Mm-hmm.
They learn.
Right.
They come to you, however, for the learning. And if you don't do something that helps them learn something better, they become very angry creatures. They're frustrated and angry creatures. They can't solve these problems. Human beings give them toys to play with and show them how to use the toys. The puppies are therefore happy because you're giving them something which is out instead of being bestial in their attitude. But mankind is different. And mankind becomes bestialized when he doesn't go forward and doesn't go to higher states of things. Why do we do it? We do it because it's there. All principles of creativity are based. Why is it done? It's done because it's there, and it would be terrible not to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And there are more elaborate, I think, ways you can describe this sort of thing, but I think for the purposes of an introduction, when you consider the mental state of most people out there, for them everything is objects. How does the object work? How does the object do this? Object, 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 object. Huh? There's no volitional characteristic. Then you say, well, there's life. Yeah, okay. But then you get to the question of human creativity, which does not exist in the animal kingdom or other forms of life. So therefore, the human capability, which is the capability that moves out into Mars and begins to solve the problems of the solar system, which simple noesis can't do, life can't do. Now you're going into the area of real creativity. So therefore, we start with a certain learning process of going upward from limits, like the object fixation, which is the lowest form of existence. Then you go to the life, which is even somebody just doing a job, copying an instruction, doing it, being satisfied that it worked, making progress by that. Not aware that they are human in the sense of noesis.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the problem lies. The problem with our populations is they don't get this distinction between animal and human noesis. They know of it as a phenomenon. They know of it as a shadow, a different kind of shadow that's cast on the wall. not like the other shadows, but they don't get the idea of what noesis really is. And what I've just referred to is simply goes into the beginning. Negate that which is not noesis, and define the way which mankind does that. Define that which is not simply noesis. And that I think is the lesson, that the first lesson we have to take people through to prepare them to look to the more challenging thing, which is really what is involved in space. Mm-hmm. The organization of solar space, even the miserable little tiniest part of solar space that we deal with apart from the sun, right? And that's I think where the concentration has to be. Then you take the work of people like Planck, and then you take Einstein. Just take those as two reference points. Now you go into the classical artistic composition, and that defines a new quality of object, the object of objects, mm-hmm. the process of cognition per se. So that we go with mankind goes to noesis, creativity, but then there's the noesis of noesis, which is true, and we're challenged to that by the very challenge of dealing with our solar space problems. We're forced to get new categories of thought which will address these problems which we now face. And it's like the person who says, well, we're going to put man on Mars. I said, no, you're going to put man on Mars. You're not if you're going to do that. You're going to kill him, because we do not have the ability to sustain human life on Mars. Mm-hmm. Maybe in some future time, after we've made transformations in the processes of the solar system, of the inner part of the solar system, maybe then we'll understand this better.
I think that's a key idea that people have to get their mind around, so to speak, is that we're dealing with a solar system, that it's not a collection of parts, but it has to be understood from, you know, as Kuza would bring up, you have to, in a sense, understand the mind of the creator that created this system as a one. What's the underlying intention, principle, which governs this entire system? And then also recognize that the system is not simply even just the planets themselves, but as we're discovering, the system is wholly populated with all types of different levels of radiation, electromagnetic characteristics. We've talked about things like the Van Allen belts, that there's this plenum of process that there that characterizes the system as a whole. And that until the mind is able to get behind the objects or the parts of it and see it as a system and say, what's the harmonic which expresses the intention of the system as a whole, we're never going to really fully be able to have dominion over that system.
It means we have to go, what I've done and introduced in the past weeks on this change in method. And that's what the next step is. But the next step is prompted mm-hmm. by an impulse which cannot be satisfied in other ways.
Right.
And therefore, this goes into the classical artistic composition as such. And actually, classical artistic composition as such is actually, in its fuller expression, is the higher form of human existence.
I mean, it really puts your humanity, what it is to be a human being, much more affirmatively in front of your eyes than science does. It's a different way of doing it, but it's more immediately accessible, you might say.
You get that.
It's more affirmative.
You get it from Kuza, you get it specifically from Kepler. Kepler raises this very specific question. That's what he wrestles with. Mm-hmm. And that is what leads right into the conception of true artistic composition. All true artistic composition is based on the challenge which we find reflected in Kuza in particular, but also in Kepler's work on the idea that he deals with a subject which is hypothetical. That's his principle. But he locates the reality of that in a higher form. And this is always done like Shakespeare does with King Henry V. where the idea of chorus shows that all the objects, all the objective features of the drama are false, that they're incomplete, that to get the truth you have to go to the higher level, you know, of the imagination. And that higher level is artistic, and now you find that everything you believed was objective was not objective. It's only a shadow cast by that which is objective. And therefore, it depends upon, everything depends upon what Kuza does with his deducta ignorantia. There's the principle. Now you get with Kepler a very specific exposition, which becomes a general principle of physics, mm-hmm. not just an explanation on the sun and so forth. This is entirely a universal principle. And to understand that principle, you have to go into the things like the artistic principles, which, like as in the case of the chorus part, the role of the chorus in King Henry V, that's the reality. What is it, the actors on stage? That's not the reality. The reality is the shadow. Mm-hmm. Therefore, we recognize that what we treat as the objects, or the definite objects, are not. They are just like Kepler's conception of the solar system. Not as an object, but as the mark of something existing beyond the object.
Right, and you see that both in his development of the intention causes the motion in the new astronomy, and then also in the way he treats even the notes of the musical system as themselves shadows in his harmonies of the world.
And so does Bach. Same thing. Same principle.
Yeah. I mean, they don't exist. They don't have Kepler does end up giving a way of tuning, but it doesn't come from the notes themselves, aren't the beginning of it.
Well, right. Are the notes themselves that have been proceeding from note to note, are these the actual realities? Or is there a motion which underlies and controls these steps by steps by steps? What controls the steps by steps by steps? What's the meaning of the musical composition? What's the meaning of Bach's Preludes and Fugues? Mm-hmm. These are particles. Do particles make music?
Right.
Some people think they do, and I wish they'd get out of the neighborhood.
or poets driven by words. I mean, you have to have a sense of language when you're trying to say something, and there is something about having the right word to use, but if you're starting
language,
from the way they sound
or
something.
Language now is then elevated by demand on a higher principle. It's not language. It's what controls language, because we have language in all kinds of uses. Dirty language, useless language, distracted language. But then we have a certain selection of principle which guides the whole process, and this is the difference. That's the garbage. Throw it out. What's the reality? And that's what we get. So therefore, the classical artistic composition, which if you look at that from the standpoint of Kuza, and you look at this from the standpoint of Kepler's concept of the solar system. The same thing. It's a principle, not, and it's just like the Shakespeare's conception of the process in King Henry V. Mm-hmm. You have the chorus. The chorus is the reality. What's the chorus? The chorus is the human beings. The human beings are reacting. That's the reality. But what about the process? Oh, that's only the effect of the reality.
And that gets at the idea, too, of recognizing that objects of the mind are not strictly demarcated things, but objects of the mind are processes of change, that there are things which you can understand as distinct, but not distinct as fixed, distinct as qualities of change, qualities of process. And that becomes then what you have to investigate. What's the one which governs the transformation or the unfolding of this process?
And specifically, from the standpoint of sense perception, a specifically unique creative action.
Right.
That's what you get with the question of in Henry V, King Henry V. What's real? What's real is the chorus. Mm-hmm. What the chorus is saying is the reality. The action otherwise defined is not the reality. And this is all artistic composition is based on that. And Kuza's work in method, in his totality of his method during his lifetime, is exactly based on that. That's the uniqueness of him.
Or he gets at the idea that the irony is ontologically more real than the parts.
If we call it irony because we don't know, we're too attached to the wrong thing. We think this is an interloper.
Right.
This is not the interloper, this is the reality.
Right.
Mm-hmm. The pregnancy in a woman is not an interloper. It's an act which is of creation of a certain kind.
Right.
And that's the whole point. What gives birth? What is the species that gives birth? And you find that in the chorus, not in the script to the players. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's the point. And so people get simplistic, and they insist that the rest of them be simplistic, and that creates a system of serfs who all do what is expected of them, and some mysterious beast who rules over them determines what they really do. And that's the other side. It's the passion to get rid of those kinds of tyrants and give the business back to humanity where it belongs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Much, much better way of living.
Yes. Well, no, this whole thing, these are obvious things for us in a certain respect. But the point is, the more important thing is they promote in us the recognition that that's not quite adequate.
That's and putting it gently.
No, and that's the point, that you're always trying to recognize and confront that which appears to be beyond control, but you know happens. And it's just people who do the same old, same old, same old, same old. They don't go anyplace. Mm-mm. Mankind's existence depends upon avoiding same old, same old, same old.
Yeah, it gets old after a while.
It gets old at the beginning, I think. I think that's where the solution lies, is the understanding of this thing that we think of how many people run around loose in society, operating on the basis of objects. The motion of objects, objective motion. And that isn't it at all. It's a category we can observe, but it's not a driver, it's not a source. Then you get to the question of life. Now things get interesting, because all these idiots that are using objects, object fixation, they have no regard for the principle of life, or life as a principle distinct on itself. Then you get the next one, where you've got living processes operating on the basis of principles associated with life. And then you find out, well, that's not it. There's a bigger one. Mankind, the human mind, is capable of introducing a form of creativity which does not exist otherwise in the universe. Now, what lies beyond that is something yet to be worked out.
Well, we've got a lot of work to do to get close to that.
But that's the point. The point is always to, when someone says, well, you can't do that, sit down, be quiet. We'll explain a few things to you. Because it's when you don't accept that, when you say, no, everything is practical, you got to be practical. That is a form of not only merely stupidity, it's a kind of intellectual suicide. And it's no fun.
Yeah.
So that's, I think, where we are. We are at that point with this kind of issue. And now you put everything we're talking about into perspective from that standpoint. It all fits. It doesn't satisfy everything, but it fits as something you have to keep working at. Mm-hmm. And you have to find critical things that you overlooked, things that are objective, but they're unique. They're not what you thought. And you find those. And you start to play with them. And you've got something. But like the distinction between man and animal, that's crucial. Like, first of all, you're out of this
dirt object, just dirt, theory of dirt. You get into life, you get into two kinds of life, two qualities of life. One, animal life. But then human life is not simply animal life. It's human creativity. And for human beings to avoid creativity is bestial.
Yeah. Yeah, if the way you're living belongs on Animal Planet, you're definitely making a mistake.
There are a lot of people there. They gathered, it's like the local zoo.
Yeah. All right.
Well, that's my contribution for the day. I hope it will stimulate something useful.
Yeah.
Okay, good. All right, well, thanks for joining us. That'll do it for this week. See you next time.
All right.